kilometers per second is nobody cares. He may have been calculating this with the Earth diameter of 19,990 kilometers. I mean, this was the science, real science of Tesla.
He made a prediction. Did he confirm it with a measurement? And, I mean, for him to make a prediction that the speed of propagation is X or C, if it wasn't backed up with a real measurement, what was his method of confirming that his precision, that his prediction was accurate? Over to you, Wes.
If you study waves, you will find out that the wavelength and the frequency are related by an equation, speed of the wave equals frequency times wavelength. And that was exactly what Tesla established, and that was Tesla work. The trick for the calculation of propagation speed is to create a sending wave of the known frequency in the medium, which is with known length. This way you can calculate the wavelength, and since you know the frequency, you can calculate the speed of the wave with the formula. And so actually, yeah.
Okay, you said you had a question now, Wes. So what is your question?
Okay, just to entertain the public, how does the magnetic field differ from the gravitational field? That is one of the series of questions. I thought this is something entertaining.
Yeah, I remember seeing one of your recommended sites to go to was by Richard Feynman, and he attempts to explain the difference between magnetic field and a gravity field. And he went through a very long explanation saying that you have to know an awful lot of things in order to relate even the beginning of an answer of that. But I think he basically came to the conclusion that gravity is very poorly understood, and magnetic fields and how those magnetic fields operate at such a long distance compared to the electrostatic field. What he was saying is that when you press your finger against the chair, was his example, you think you're really touching the wood of the chair. In reality, those molecules on the surface of your skin have a very strong electrostatic repulsion of those electrons on the outside of every one of those molecules, and the same thing with the chair, the wood of the chair, and therefore it feels to you like you're touching the chair. In reality, you come very close. You're coming within the nanometers, but you come very close. You don't really touch the chair. But in the case of electrostatic repulsion inside of molecules has an extremely short range of operation because each individual molecule is almost a balanced, charged object. The nucleus is a certain amount of positive, the electrons are the exact same amount of negative, and locally it almost balances. Let me drop. So he gave that as an example that electrostatic effects, attraction and repulsion, are very short-ranged in normal experience. But magnetic field, for reasons that are not so clear, has a much, much longer range of influence. And gravity is super weak by comparison, but again, an extremely long range of influence, galactic ranges. I don't think anybody can really explain gravity. I think the Large Hadron Collider hopes to find some evidence of what a graviton is. And magnetic field, what really is that magnetic field? Darn interesting question. I don't think I know. Do you know, and do you know anyone who does know? N2XJN, K2LIW.
Hey, before that, does anybody want to contribute to the subject? How does the magnetic field differ from a gravitational field?
Away, Professor.
Now, I believe that there is an extremely weak interaction between magnetic field and gravitational field. And what makes me say that is that most of the astronomers now have very little problem accepting the phenomenon in astronomy astronomical research, astrophotography, of gravity lensing. In other words, if you're looking at an extremely distant galaxy or quasar, and if between you and that very distant galaxy that might be 10 billion light years away, if midway between the two there is a massive galaxy, the light from that far galaxy gets bent around the slightly nearer galaxy. Therefore, you will see multiple images of the far galaxy. Gravity lensing effect. That's a fairly strong piece of evidence that the local gravity of that intermediate galaxy is bending those light waves from the far galaxy. That's one explanation. There is the possibility of a refractive index taking place. In other words, the gas cloud around that mid-location galaxy could die by way of its refractive index, by way of its variation of dielectric constant versus position, could also be giving you a bending effect. The radio waves that are used by the microwave enthusiasts on the Earth, let me drop. The guys on 10 gigs, and I used to be one of them, haven't been active lately, but I want to get back to it, have often experienced what's called the super refraction effect, which means that you get a band opening on 10 gigs, on the 10,000 megahertz band, some portion of every 24-hour day on average, particularly beyond midnight at night in the summertime, when the air mass is cooling off and you get the dew, a high humidity near the ground, and a drier air up high, the water weight laden air, the air with a higher humidity has a higher dielectric constant, and it creates a downward bending of the wave. As such, a person 400 miles away, normally my radio horizon is about 40 miles, but I can talk to somebody 400 miles away, and he sounds like he's in my backyard, because that radio wave from him toward me bends and follows Earth's curvature because of this atmospheric effect called super refraction. So dielectric effects will bend a radio wave. But that's not gravity. It may look like gravity doing it, but it's not, because it disappears on a dry day. Gravity lensing, though, appears to really be gravity doing it. So very weakly, I think there is an interaction between gravity and you could say magnetic field, because that electromagnetic wave does partially consist of magnetism.
I agree.
So, over to you for any comments on this one, Wes. K2RIW.
You made a very interesting point. Very interesting point. Gravitational fields are determined only by the mass or mass energy of the body. Charged and uncharged massive particles produce the same gravitational fields pound for pound. Well, the electromagnetic energy has its own mass, so it does contribute a bit. For a long period of time, people, and including me, were thinking how to interact with the steady magnetic fields of the magnet. And if that was possible, actively have the interaction, energy exchange, or any other way of interaction, that would be great. So, if the electromagnetic energy has its own mass, and it does contribute a bit, that means that we could, in theory, use it as a tool. Let me drop. Magnetic fields are produced by charged particles in motion and depends on charge and velocity of these particles, but not on their mass. Magnetic fields are polar fields with north and south polarity. So, the gravitational fields have no polarity at all. So here we have a kind of something to think about it. At large distances, gravitational fields diminish as the inverse square of the distance from the source. So the magnetic fields are at large distances from their source decrease. distance. So you can only detect magnetic fields by using charged particles to measure their deflections. The gravitational fields can be detected by using anything to measure a change in velocity. Enter Exia.
Yeah, one of the things you mentioned earlier is, does radio waves have mass? And the answer is yes. The solar energy coming from the sun, just the light portion of it, not talking about the solar wind, I'm talking about the real light output of the sun, roughly 1290 watts per square meter, is what we see here on the surface of the Earth. If you build a solar sail, you will measure a light pressure on that sail. And they've already done some experiments with satellites to do this, with spacecraft. And the approximate magnitude, as I remember, was something like 4 microtesla. Just to calibrate that, the air pressure that we're experiencing at sea level is something like 100,000, I said Tesla, 100,000, here we go, 6 micropascal, if that's the right word, pascal. A pascal is a newton per square meter. It's a unit of pressure in the SI system. So the air pressure that you're experiencing in your room is roughly 100,000 pascals. 100,000 newtons per square meter is the air pressure in that room with you right now. But the solar wind, the solar energy hitting a sail, if you put one up, would give you 4 micropascals. So you compare the 4 micropascal to 100,000 pascal of air pressure, and the ratio is roughly 100,000 to 1. So solar pressure is 100,000 times weaker than air pressure. So if you build yourself a solar sail, you're not going to move your sail down very fast. It's a very small amount of energy to accelerate your spacecraft. It's going to take a long time. The price...
Timeout, cancel.
The good news is that a solar sail, the price is right. And it's continuous. You could be accelerating yourself with a solar sail for the next 10 years if you wanted to. And you don't need 10 years worth of fuel. The sun supplies that for you. That's the good news. The bad news is the pressure is really much, much less than flea power, if you know what I mean. So it's kind of hard to use. But that's a fairly strong piece of evidence that a radio wave does have mass. A light wave does have mass, because when it strikes your sail, it imparts a measurable force to your sail. And that's already been done as a spacecraft experiment, and the confirmation is pretty good. But that is not a very strong piece of evidence for, in my mind yet, the interaction between gravity and magnetic field. Other than gravity lensing, I don't know of any other experimental confirmation. And maybe you do, Wes. Enter XJN, K2RIW.
No, I don't, although I think I might. The thing is that I'm just thinking of the resourcing right now, any possible way of interaction, but there was another question that I have to ask you. There was 1 year ago when I had the discussion with you, Glenn, Eric, and a few others, and I said that the long waves are kept nearby the Earth, and that's why you have, during the night time, a very long propagation of 3.5 megahertz, just because of the gravity. And the statement was, no, electromagnetic waves do not have a mass. This theory was taught to me in 1975. No, not even 1971. I was a young fellow at the time. And that was the theory of Europe. Are we coming back to that and to Adrian?
When you measure solar pressure, solar illumination pressure of 4 micropascals, you could say that's an extremely strong pressure, extremely small pressure, and you could say the sun as a transmitter is an extremely strong transmitter. The sun puts out something like 10 to the 27 power, one with 27 zeros after it. That's approximately the watt output of the sun, a really potent transmitter. So when that potent transmitter, yes, it's at a long range, when that potent transmitter puts out this really strong signal, 1290 watts per square meter, you compare that to the watts per square meter you're getting out of the radio signal you're sending to that repeater right now. And we're talking about millions to one of ratio. So the sun as a transmitter is extremely strong. And yet the solar pressure you get from that strong transmitter is, by my standards, extremely weak. So yes, a radio wave does have mass, but the mass is so extremely small that it's very difficult to use, measure, sense, or whatever, unless you have this extreme situation of a 10 to the 27 watt transmitter giving you this three power pressure that you can measure here. So you can almost say that a radio wave has no mass, and you're close to being accurate, is one way of looking at it. When the number is that small, you could almost say it has none, and most of the time you might come up with the right conclusion, as long as you're not looking for the ninth decimal place of accuracy. That's an opinion. OWS, K2RIW.
Okay, and to XGN. Well, I think if the gravitational field would have anything to do with the electromagnetic energy that has its own mass, and it does contribute to it, that it has to be any impact whatsoever of any number in between doubt and to exam.
Can you envision an experiment by which you could confirm?
No, not at this point.
Hey, we finally got him. Hey, John, we asked him a question that not even the Europeans have got an answer for. Have those guys in Richmond got an answer? What do you think, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
No, Dick, I don't have an answer. Just like I can't answer how a magnet works yet. When I find out, I will let you know. I found out one interesting thing about our 36 billion year cycle of the disasters on the Earth, which I'll let you know later when we pick that up.
Yeah, we've had 5 mass extinctions on the Earth. In other words, a high percentage of all the living organisms on planet Earth throughout the 4.5 million year history of Earth, 4.5 billion years, sorry about that, 4.5 billion years the Earth has been around. 5 times, a high percentage of the life disappeared. I think the last one was something like 60 million years ago when all the dinosaurs disappeared. So we've been through some disasters, we meaning this planet and the life on this planet. And is that sort of what you're getting at here, John? When you look at these ice records, you dig down in Antarctica, or Arctic or Antarctica, and you bring up these ice cores, and you analyze the bubbles that are in the ice cores, and you can find out what the atmosphere was like at that time. And that gives you a lot of information. That's a lot better than looking at tree rings, if you know what I mean. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Well, Dick, it seems that the astronomers have found an oscillation with our sun, which, of course, we follow our sun as it travels through the galaxy. But they found another motion of the sun, which they didn't realize, and they've confirmed that the sun oscillates in vertical directions in our galaxy also. We have that planar disk that is slowly accreting, and as we drift up, we go out of many of the star and asteroid fields, and then we dip down again. I don't know how many degrees or how far above the galaxy we go or below, but we drift through the star field, not only horizontally in the XY direction, but we're all doing it in the Z direction of the galaxy too, which was not known. And I happened to catch that program last week. Very interesting information, and it seems to be a 36 million year cycle. And they're trying to show that since the Earth was formed, it seems to have been going through this, and they couldn't figure out why we went through these disasters on the Earth. As you know, you see the pictures when the Earth was a melted blob coming together and it got hit with a planet the size of Mars, which made our moon. But going through these fields, we collected larger and larger asteroids that really do the damage. So I don't know what part of the cycle we're in right now, but that was very interesting to find that out.
You probably know, John, I know that the Earth is part of the solar system. Our sun is part of this galaxy we call the Milky Way galaxy. And our sun makes one circle around that particular galaxy. The whole thing is turning like a wheel. And we make one circle in, I think the number is 250,000 years, but I'm not sure.
Friday, WS2X.
Yes, let's have the concept. Is it 250,000 years, roughly, Paul? Go ahead.
That's right. 250,000 years, all the way around the galaxy.
But what, John?
It's 250,000,000, isn't it?
1 billion.
Fantastic. All right, 250,000,000 years, one circle. And the sun is simultaneously bobbing up and down. The whole galaxy is one great big pie plate, if you know what I mean. And so we're in one of the arms of that pie plate. There's a whole bunch of spiral arms, and we're in one of them. And I think you're saying that our solar system, our sun, is also not only going around once every 250,000,000 years, make one circle, but we're also bobbing up and down. Is the cycle once every 36 million years? Is that the number, John? And that bobbing up and down, as we bob up and down, we either go through the mass center of this plate, and then we go to the rarefied region down at the negative peak and the positive peak. So as we go through the mass center, possibly we pick up a lot more articles in the Oort cloud and the, I can't remember that. There's two great big clouds out there. One of them is called the Oort cloud. I can't think of the name of it.
Kuiper belt.
There it is, the Kuiper belt. So Kuiper belt and Oort cloud, we pick up a whole lot of these strange guys, a whole lot of drifters, and every so often one of them is going to hit the Earth and give us maybe a mass extinction. And one of the predictions is that to really have a successful solar system, you need a couple of outlier massive planets like Jupiter and Saturn, which on many occasions, they collect the stuff that would have hit us. As you remember that Shoemaker-Levy 9 thing that hit Jupiter, if that hit the Earth instead of Jupiter, it would have been very significant. Maybe this is some of what you're telling us, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
That's correct, Dick. And that Jupiter has been collecting the dust collector out there. And, of course, our sun brings all of the planets with it as it goes. We're almost a closed system. You could think of it as a sine wave traveling through the rings of Jupiter. That's basically what it's like. And it's really brought a lot of changes to the Earth. And this is something that they've just realized recently. And I think it was 36 million years. So, you know, we've got a few years to go before we'll see it again. But very interesting stuff. There's so much to learn. And the problem is, the more I learn, the more ignorant I realize I am. It's a very difficult situation, Dick. Back to you.
You're not alone on that one, John. The smart man knows something about what he doesn't know. And there's a lot more to be learned for all of mankind. Those mass extinctions are something to worry about. The near-Earth objects, in other words, the objects that are going to come near us in the future. Up till now, we haven't spent much time studying them, looking for them, and we certainly right now don't have any real defense mechanism. If we found out that some object out there is going to hit the Earth in 20 years, and there's a slim possibility of that, and you know that that impact is going to be very significant in the amount of damage it does, that it might create what's called a nuclear winter, if we had 20 years forewarning that a major impact of a celestial object, an asteroid, a comet, whatever, is going to hit us, would we in 20 years be able to convince the population to put forth the effort to design and build the hardware that could modify that outcome? Could we go out there with some kind of a spacecraft and steer that object a little bit differently so that we don't get impacted? There's been lots of science fiction about that. Was it a Day of Armageddon or something like that? But there's been at least two science fictions on that story, maybe more. And to get the funding to do that, to do it, to carry it out accurately, not easy. I wonder if the program you saw, and by the way, I suspect it wasn't a NOVA program. I wonder which one of the science channels were you watching with that program about the 36 million year bobbing of the sun. Did they mention anything about defensive mechanisms if we discover that the Oort cloud or the Kuiper belt is going to give us something that's going to be very unhappy? Over to you, John, K2RIW.
I think that program was on the Discovery Channel, and I did see another program about 6 months ago which went into all different types of analysis that NASA's doing to see what they could do. Definitely exploding it is not going to work. But what you had mentioned before, the solar sail, as weak as it is, can change a very large object, and also maybe to use an explosive to cause outgassing, which would of course make it like a rocket and it would deflect it. They would only have to do it, of course, the greater the distance, the less the angle, a minute amount to change the crossing point. So, yeah, they're really spending a lot of money and a lot of research going into that. But, you know, there's another thing to think about here. If you look about the possibility of an asteroid, a comet, then look at eruptions of humongous volcanoes that are possible, and global warming and all of the things that are threatening us, the percentage is getting closer to the disaster side than it is the good side. Have you thought about that?
In a way, yes. One of those TED programs literally talks about emphasizing happiness ratio of the population, that we tend to study and what grabs our attention most of the time are all the bad news, all the potential disasters. Our population really favors the bad news. There's an awful lot of good news. And the United States is not the happiest nation, for instance. I know that Scandinavia is considered considerably happier, and I think it was Costa Rica was considered the happiest country. I may have it wrong, but it was a Central American country that was considered the happiest. We can depress the living daylights out of our population by emphasizing all the things that can go wrong. And yes, you have to admit there's a problem before you can solve it. So if there really was a serious global warming situation, and that's not absolutely assured yet, let me drop. Because the ice cores are demonstrating the fact that there was some huge thermal cycles, ice ages in the past, ice ages and warm periods, long before mankind was doing anything. So Mother Nature does do that all on her own. We seem to be in this last thermal cycle, though, by all the fossil fuels we're burning and the amount of carbon loading that we're doing in the atmosphere. We are certainly contributing to it. And the amount of ice we're melting at the poles and whatever is pretty strong evidence. And I, for one, would love to see us do a lot more renewable energy resources. The fact that we give $1 billion a day to foreign nations so that they can supply us the 20 million barrels a day of oil that we burn. The fact that we're so energy dependent that 60% of our petroleum energy is coming from off of our shores. How we tolerate that is amazing to me. As we go to the renewable energy resources, wind, solar, tides, thermal, geothermal, solar voltaic, and whatever, essentially all of those have very little carbon loading compared to burning fossil fuels, petroleum. We've got to either produce our own petroleum or use alternates. And that's a great solution. It would put a whole lot of people to work. It's very disappointing that the apparently the Obama administration decided to fund a solar voltaic company that after they gave them a lot of funding, they went bankrupt. Somebody didn't do due diligence enough there, didn't investigate. Was that particular investment shovel-ready, as they say? There was something wrong there. There's a lot of lessons to be learned. But still, I'd like to see an awful lot of renewable energy resource production. If this was a wartime, we would find a way to produce the hardware as we did in World War II, produce tremendous amounts of hardware that really changed the tide of that war. And so there is a minor war going on right now, an energy war and a carbon loading war. We have the resources to do something about it. I wish we were doing more. I bet you guys have got some opinion on all of this. K2RIW listening.
Into Exxon.
Need a Manhattan Project, Dick.
Okay, I heard Wesley, John, and who was the third person?
Paul, WS2N.
Okay, Wesley, John, and Paul, in that order. Go ahead, Wes. Well, if you were president, which one of the renewable energy resources would you be investing in, Wesley? If the XJN company was investing its vast resources into renewable energy, which one would you choose? Into XJN, K2RIW?
Did you read my two first emails that I have sent you? Now that is one that I sent you an hour ago.
I might not have. I was in a major repair operation this afternoon, so go ahead and tell me the subject matter if you want to.
This is the answer to your question, Dick. None of them, no renewable sources, the new sources of the energy. You have very valuable materials over there. I don't want to discuss that material. I have another question. The third image that I have sent you is very easy to discuss, but that would be after we finish this subject. I just ask John to confirm that whatever I have sent you is true, at least to the point of the documentary values. John?
KC2WGB. True or not, I don't know, but I've seen the documents, and it looks like they're leading to the point that Wesley was trying to bring out about this energy project. But my feeling with energy, Dick, I think we need a Manhattan Project, without a doubt. I don't believe that windmills are the answer. They're part of the answer. We could use them. I agree with Ty. Geothermal works excellent. That should be really pursued. But I think the hydrogen fuel cell is where the big dollar should go into. And I know Glenn knows a lot more about it than I do, but it seems like something that can be done. If we were to put billions of dollars into it, I think it could be done, and probably within my lifetime.
Yeah, Dick, one more thing. I'm really asking you, when you have the time, go to this two first emails that I have sent you. We're not discussing this in here as we. The third email, that would be the next question of mine. You need really to prepare yourself for that conversation. conversation from these two emails. Enter it here.
I'll try to.
V2U in a moment.
I think it was WV2U. I'd like to hear about you. Oh, I had a quick question for John about hydrogen fuel cell, but WV2U? I know you. Your audio is a little bit low. Go right ahead with your question or comment, sir.
Statement about the different temperature cycles that the Earth has been going through. I think I saw a show a couple of a month or two ago on the Discovery Channel that they were talking about that we are now in the process of exiting an ice age. So we are on a naturally occurring warming trend. And the global warming thing, I think, is, you know, it's a measurable thing. And yes, the Earth is getting warmer, but I've always been curious as to how much is naturally occurring and, you know, how much is really being caused by, you know, our fossil fuel burning and so forth. We certainly can't be helping the problem.
Yeah, I think you're right on that one, Paul. But, John, the hydrogen fuel cell, where does the energy come from? And if it's a kind of a battery that you have to charge, where's the energy going to come from to charge it? Give us a few more words on the hydrogen fuel cell, John. Go ahead.
I know it exists. I'm not versed well on it. But I would like them to pursue the same type that they've used in the space program. It seems to be very efficient and very durable. I know we can't go into any type of nuclear reactors because you can't give that to the public. But the fuel cell, a little bit dangerous, but something that will work, I think, efficiently for each home and possibly even cars. But at least for home heating and home energy, that's what I would like to see. And I know the problem seems to be, Eric and I have spoken about it many times, it seems to be the membrane. Designing that transit membrane that is giving them the biggest problem, and that's where the science has to be, where we have to look.
I vaguely remember that the main source of electrical energy on the Apollo space program was the so-called fuel cells. The fuel cells definitely needed a source of oxygen, and I hadn't thought about that until now, but they must have needed a source of hydrogen too. I think the resultant output product was electrical energy and water.
WS2N, you're right, Dick.
Glad to hear that, Paul. So raw liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen went into the fuel cell, out came kilowatts of electrical power and water. And I guess with some purification, that water was even potable water. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, definitely. Hydrogen and oxygen, you wind up with water without the minerals. So, yeah, that was first used on Gemini. Gemini was the first. Mercury didn't have it, but Gemini was the first one with fuel cells. And that enabled them to go on their extended missions instead of a couple of orbits. They were able to stay up like for five days, you know, as the Gemini mission progressed, and eventually 8 days, and then they had a record 14-day flight that would have never been possible without the fuel cells. So, but the problem is getting all this hydrogen. That's expensive. You can use methane. You can use that. But that's you have to get that, too. So, you know, you have to get the fuel. You have to get the oxygen. You know, you don't get something for nothing, Dick. You know, that's the problem. But would it be less expensive than fossil, you know, fossil fuels like coal and oil? I don't know. I think right now it would be more expensive. But like John says, you know, put a Manhattan Project behind it, and in the future maybe that would be the way to go. I want to make one comment about global warming, Dick.
Go ahead, Paul.
You believe that there's really a war going on with this global warming. But I don't think the population itself really considers it that serious. More so than they used to.
Two O2 tanks on board
to supply oxygen for the system. The one was blown out. The other one, I think, was leaking. So, on 14, 15, 16, 17, they did add another tank, a third tank, instead of just the two. So, I don't know if you could... I haven't heard that, so I don't know. I know they have it on the space shuttle, the fuel cells, and when they hooked up to the space station and took the power from the space station solar panels to extend the missions instead of like 12-day missions, you could make it 16 or 18 days if you wanted to the space station. You got all this extra power. They really shut down their fuel cells. Whether they shut them off, maybe they let them, maybe they were like on a triple charge or something. I don't know. But as far as I was concerned, they were shutting them down to save power for the space shuttle for the return to Earth. Back to you, Dick.
From what you're saying, Paul, it sounds like they're capable of being turned down as long as you don't completely turn them off. I think they can turn them down so that you drastically lower the rate of consumption of the consumables on the space shuttle when you're docked with the space station and you're using the solar panels of the space station to reverse feed the space shuttle. That's what I think is going on here. So it looks like the problem with the Apollo 13 was that one of the oxygen tanks, because of the failed heater thermal switch, the heater went on continuously, overpressured that one, it exploded. And the remaining oxygen tank, I'm guessing, was leaking its fuel back through the piping of the exploded one. And they had to turn off that critical valve, which did kill at least one, if not both, of the fuel cells on board. And I know that they were worried about the fact that once they turned it off, they could never turn it back on again because of the leak or because of the fuel cell itself couldn't be restarted. I'm not quite sure. So, John, when it comes to the hydrogen fuel cell, hydrogen-oxygen fuel cell, you believe that a tank of liquid hydrogen and a tank of liquid oxygen on a vehicle with a fuel cell would do a good job of powering an electric vehicle. My thinking right now is that it's very, very difficult to exceed. Let me drop.
Well, I didn't mention cars, Dick. I don't know about cars, but the home, I think, is a good idea.
And that's sort of where I'm going. In the case of petroleum, the energy density of watts per kilogram, of joules per kilogram of petroleum is a huge number. Very difficult to exceed that with batteries or anything else. So I see some merit in continuing to run our vehicles on petroleum. But all of the fixed locations, homes and factories, I don't think should be using petroleum. They should be using everything else but, because their portability of the energy source is not so important. It is in the case of a vehicle. I think we could cut down our petroleum use by very large percentages if we only allowed them to use on vehicles, but everywhere else we stopped and used renewable energy resources. And when it comes to the renewable, I think you're saying one of the methods of storing energy locally might be hydrogen, oxygen, or hydrogen fuel cell, because the oxygen comes essentially free from the air, so that you're storing hydrogen locally to run your source of power for the home or factory. And in space, you've got to have both the hydrogen and oxygen, but on the Earth, only the hydrogen is required, and that's a rather high energy density storage medium, better than batteries or any other technique that we know of storing energy other than petroleum for a fixed location. Is that approximately what that science program was saying, Paul? John, KT2WGB, K2LIW?
Yes, the hydrogen being so ubiquitous that maybe we could use solar cells in a home to process that substance so we could have that. And it's the same thing we had trouble with the Manhattan Project. Enrico Fermi could not maintain a chain reaction until they started pouring money into it and getting a collective brain throughout the world to get this going. And I think if we had the same impetus there. Now, then we had a good starting point. We had a terrible war coming on. We had to put an end to it. We've got, as you said, this is another war. And we have the manufacturers building cars that could do 200 miles an hour when the speed limit is 55, 65. Sort of insane to me. Maybe that should be looked at. We could drop the consumption of fuel. We could do a lot of things that I don't think they're doing right now. So that brain power has to think down a lot of avenues. All right, some of them may be dead in the street, but as we start cutting down and we can sort of transfer the application to windmills, which happen to work excellent out west. I was in a farm field out there of a huge size out in California, and it was doing a job. Cannot fight that. But that's not going to work here in Staten Island. It's not going to work where you live. Well, where you live, maybe you've got a sparse population, but it would never work in the city. So all these things have to be taken into consideration, and we have to look at every avenue. That's how I believe. And I think they could do it if they wanted to, but it's a big influence to stop it, too.
When you were out in California and you saw a very large wind farm, I wonder if you saw the same one I saw. This is north of the Mojave Desert. Take Route 14 to get there. The Tehachapi Mountains is where it, I think it is. Was it the Tehachapi Mountain wind farm? Is that the one that you were seeing, John? Go ahead.
Dick, I don't remember that name. I'm going to try to think of it. I'll let you know if I think of it. It was huge. I mean, it was miles long. It was huge.
What was the nearest town or thing that I would recognize? Were you north of the Mojave Desert? Were you vaguely in the vicinity of China Lake Naval Air Station? Go ahead.
I'm drawing a total blank there. I know it was a flat desert area. Indian nations. I can't come up with anything. I'll think.
Okay. Was it a high desert area?
I don't believe so. I don't remember. It was very flat, the whole area. And it had a hill nearby where a cable car up to the top of the a scenic spot. And you could look down into the area.
Was it the Mojave Desert?
I think it could have been. I'm trying to remember the name of the town. Or at least the tribe. I feel so retarded.
I've had that problem. I'm not sure. Is Mojave an Indian word?
Oh, yes. I believe that might be Navajo.
Okay. We'll eventually find that wind farm. But yes, some of the wind farms have not been properly maintained, but some of them are very successful. And to get power out of wind is an awful nice way to go. There are people who think that they're going to be damaging birds and creating acoustic sounds that are hard to detect and hard to tolerate and interfering with them. Over the broadcast signals, I think most of these complaints are rather minor ones. There's been a couple of proposals to put a good-sized wind farm off the south shore of Long Island, 4 miles out. And a fair number of people are saying, not in my backyard, I don't want these unsightly things. And to a technologically oriented person, I'd like to believe that they would consider a wind farm a beautiful piece of technology and what it's doing for saving energy and saving carbon loading and whatever and global warming and the long-range benefits. The problem is it's hard to fund because if a particular administration says, yes, we're going to do this, and the project is not going to be completed during that administration, they're afraid they don't get credit for it. So we don't start. We keep saying that we're not going to do offshore drilling, we're not going to do many of the renewable energy resources, because it's not going to give us a solution fast enough. And that's not a good enough answer from my point of view. The longest journey begins with the first step. And as long as you're fairly sure you've got a beneficial journey, it's time we start. regardless of whose administration it gets finished on. We've got to look at the bigger picture. That's my thinking on that one. Give us a couple more words, John, on the hydrogen fuel cell. Had they developed the membrane that does the work, in other words, except for the degree of difficulty of forming the hydrogen and storing it, was the actual thing that creates the electrical power from hydrogen, was that reasonably well perfected in the articles in the science report that you saw? KC2WGB, K2LIW.
I wish Eric was around. He knows more about it than I do. The program that I saw, that seems to be the only thing holding back the fuel cell from being accepted for a reliable power source. Once they get that straightened out, it seems that the membrane breaks down. I don't know whether it perforates or clogs, what the issue is, but that's one of the main issues. Now, as far as these wind farms, you just happened to mention a sore point that I have with that. You've got these people who don't want it off their shore, they're part of the... Okay. But, as you know, when you saw the wind farm, usually they're white. They're very big. They're large. But when you get a couple of miles away, as they'll be out to sea, they sort of blend in. And if we would paint them sky color or, you know, a blue or a green, I don't think most people, I know I wouldn't be able to see it, but I don't think it would be objectionable. And nobody would hear the noise. Maybe if you're passing by in a sailboat, you know, possibly. But what is wrong with people? You know, don't build it in my backyard. it's just insanity. But I think the fuel cell deserves at least a couple of $100 billion, because while they're looking at that, they may find another area. It's just like when I speak to you about a technical subject and you change my direction of how to look at something. I come around from another angle. It sure helps, Dick.
I'm trying to think whether or not I've seen portions of the program you're talking about. When they were making the membrane that does the work in this hydrogen fuel cell, were they making round discs of material by putting the raw ingredients into a press and heavily pressing this material to make this disc that does the real operation and then stacking those together? Was that part of the program, John? Go ahead.
The filters did contain crystals, but they were, it looked very similar to the HVAC filter that would slide into your air handler. Only it was approximately, I think it was maybe like 13 inches square, and there was a multiplicity of them.
Does sound like a different program. Now, when it comes to hydrogen-powered vehicles, I believe that they are being experimented on quite seriously in Iceland. I wonder if you've seen that program, John. Go ahead.
No, Dick, I didn't. Sounds interesting.
Iceland has hydrogen gas stations, so to speak, and a bus company is running their buses on them, and the tanks are actually in the roof of the bus. And that seems to be quite successful. I think the geothermal energy of Iceland is supplying the raw energy that allows them to refine the hydrogen, which is now available at these things that look like gas stations. And you pull up to the gas station and connect the hose to your vehicle, and you load in the hydrogen. And I'm not sure whether that's being loaded in compressed gaseous form or in liquid form. But there, I'm not sure. I think it's likely to be compressed gas, not liquid. To live with the cryogenic temperatures to sustain liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, I think is relatively difficult. I think simply compressing it is good enough when it comes to fixed locations on the Earth. You might be enthusiastic about liquefying if you had to have a higher energy density for a vehicle. But maybe we should continue to use petroleum on vehicles, but very efficient engines on petroleum. From time to time, I hear that a hybrid vehicle, which has an extremely efficient, small combustion engine